Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven, stay driven.
Gentlemen, welcome back to the Bareback Facts. For those of you new to the show, I'd like to introduce myself. I am Dallas, otherwise known as Big D. You can also catch me Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. Eastern Time for Straight Football Talk with Teddy the Bear Tate every week. Today, I'm going to be your host for the Bareback Facts. However, a show where we delve into things such as politics, religion, mythology, and the lives of notorious and infamous people throughout history. Today, specifically, we're going to be delving into the realm of mythology to uncover and track the legend of the Hindu figure Karna. Now, Karna is one of the most controversial figures within the Hindu faith. He features prominently in the Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, and is a central figure there, along with the other Hindu hero, Arjuna. He is quite prominently is that he once conquered the entire known world and was set up to assault the very heavens. So we're going to be talking about Karna's journey from humble beginnings all the way to mighty king and emperor of all the known world, and what ultimately brings about his downfall. And try and delve into the inner complexities of Karna as a character. But before we get into all that, I would like to remind our normal listeners and enlighten our new listeners that we do have a call-in number here at Totally Driven Entertainment. It's 718-508-9883. And so if you have questions, comments, concerns, or you just want to hear my beautiful voice and you just want to exchange dialogue with me, you can call in at any time. But do keep it relevant to the to what we're talking about if you can. Now, without further ado, let's dive right into this. And let's not wait any longer. So first off, let's talk a little bit about the Mahabharata. First off, it is one of the two major Sanskrit epics of ancient India. The other is known as the Ramayana. It's the epic narrative of the Kurukshetra War and the fates of the Kaurava and Pandava princes. Now, it also contains philosophical and devotional material such as a discussion of the four goals of life, or the Parasartha. Among the principal works and the stories in the Mahabharata are the Bhagavad Gita, the story of Damayanti, and an abbreviated version of the Ramayana and the story of Rishyavringa, often considered as works in their own right. So the Mahabharata is quite large. Now, traditionally, the authorship is attributed to Vyasa, and this is a central and revered figure in most Hindu religions. It's also sometimes called Veda Vyasa, the one who classified the Vedas, or Krishna Dipayana, referring to his complexion and birthplace. He's considered to be the author of the Mahabharata, and as well as a scribe of both the Vedas and the Puranas. Vyasa is considered to be one of the seven long-lived or immortals known as the Chiranjeevans, who are still in existence according to Hindu belief. Now, according to the Vishnu Purana, Veda Vyasa is a title applied to the compilers of the Vedas, who are avatars of Vishnu, and supposedly 28 people with this title have appeared so far in history. The festival of Guru Purnima is dedicated to him, and it is also known as Vyasa Purnima, for it is the day believed to be both his birthday and the day he divided the Vedas. So this is there's a little bit of mythicness to the origins of the stories as well. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with Hinduism, much of it is the compiled teachings of individuals known as the gurus. Gurus were early philosophers in the earliest periods of Hindu history that we have all recorded. And they did a lot of the compiling of not only what later becomes holy text, but also of history and philosophy. And much of what we know of the region comes from these gurus. So whether or not Vyasa is actually whether it was actually the name of a real person or simply a title that was passed from generation to generation, which is more likely, it's probably much more likely that it's a title attributed to one of these gurus. Nonetheless, there have been many attempts to unravel its historical growth and compositional layers. The oldest preserved parts of the text are thought to be not much older than around 400 BC, though the origins of the epic most likely fall between the 8th and 9th centuries BC. Now, the text probably reached its form by the early Gupta period, which is 4th century CE, and the title may be translated as the Great Tale of the Bharata Dynasty. According to the text itself, the tale is extended from a shorter version of 24,000 verses simply called Bharata. Now, the Mahabharata is the longest epic poem known and has been described as the longest poem ever written. Its longest version consists of over 100,000 sloka, or over 200,000 individual verse lines. Each sloka is a couplet and long prose passages. So there's prose in there as well. At about 1.8 million words in total, the Mahabharata is roughly 10 times the length of the Iliad and the Odyssey combined, and about 4 times the length of the Ramayana. Now, one W.J. Johnson has compared the importance of the Mahabharata in the context of world civilization to that of the Bible, the works of Shakespeare, the works of Homer, Greek drama, or the Quran. So this is probably one of the most influential pieces of literature ever written. It is also one of the longest pieces of early literature ever composed, and it is the longest epic poem that we know of today, trumping both the Odyssey and the Iliad. And for those of you unfamiliar with the Odyssey and the Iliad, those are the works of Homer. And the Iliad is the epic of Troy. The Odyssey is the aftermath of Troy and the journey of Odysseus, the Greek hero, headed home from the Trojan War, and his adventure with some of the other heroes from the Trojan War who survived. Now, the epic is traditionally ascribed to the sage Vyasa, who's also a major character in it. Vyasa described it as being history. He also describes the guru Shishya Parampara, which traces all great teachers and their students of the Vedic times. Now, the first section, Ganesa, who wrote down the text to Vyasa's dictation, so apparently the first Vyasa dictated all this to another person who wrote it down. The epic employs the story within a story structure otherwise known as frame tales, popular in many Indian religious and non-religious works. It's first recited by the sage Vaisampayana, a disciple of Vyasa, to the king Janamjaya, who is the great-grandson of the Pandava prince Arjuna. And the story is then recited again by a professional storyteller named Ugrasrava Sauti much later to an assemblage of sages performing the 12-year sacrifice for the king Sanuka Kalapati in the Namisa Forest. Now, the text has been described by some early 20th century Western Indologists as unstructured and chaotic. One of these earlier scholars, Herman Oldenburg, supposed that the original poem must have carried an immense tragic force, but dismissed the full text as a horrible chaos. Another individual, Moritz Winternitz, considered that only unpoetical theologists and clumsy scribes origin into an unordered whole. Now, these, of course, are later critiques of this work, and as you go through the Mahabharata, there are some twists and turns in there that can be a little bit difficult to follow, and this is all sort of just background precursor stuff to the actual story we're going to be talking about, but I think it's important. I think you guys get some background in this story before we really get into it. Now, research on the epic has put an enormous effort into recognizing and dating the layers within the text. Some elements of the present epic of the Mahabharata can be taken back to Vedic times. The background to the epic suggests that the origin of the epic occurs after the very early Vedic period and before the first Indian empire was to rise in the 3rd century. That this is a date not too far removed from the 8th or 9th century BC is likely. Now, the Mahabharata started as an orally transmitted tale of the charioteer bards, and it is generally agreed that unlike the Vedas, which have been preserved letter perfect, the epic was a popular work whose reciters would evidently conform to changes in language and style. And so the earliest surviving components of this dynamic text are believed to be no older than the earliest external references we have to it, which may include an allusion in Panini's 4th century BC work, Astantyayi. And it is estimated that the Sanskrit text probably reached something of a final form by the early Gupta period, which is about the 4th century. So, Vishnu Sukthakar, editor of the first great critical edition of the epic, commented that it is useless to think of reconstructing a fluid text in a literally original shape on the basis of an archetype and a stemma codicum when what then is possible. Our objective can only be to reconstruct the oldest form of the text which is possible to reach on the basis of the manuscript material that we have available. So that manuscript evidence is somewhat late given its material composition and the climate of India, but it's still very extensive. So there's still a lot of writing, a lot of stories that are kind of lumped together into this epic that existed and survived. And so they're forced to look. The Mahabharata distinguishes a core portion of 24,000 verses, the Bharata proper, as opposed to an additional secondary material, while another text, the Asvaya Sutra, makes a similar distinction. At least three redactions of the text are commonly recognized. The Jaya, which is translated as victory, with 8,800 verses attributed to Visaya, Vyasa, and the Bharata with 24,000 verses as recited by another sage, Vatsampayana, and finally the epic part of the Mahabharata as recited by Ugrasavra Sauti with over 100,000 verses. So there's a lot of different opinions on who wrote which parts and how many verses can be attributed to which guys. But some scholars still argue that referring to previous texts, or that they are part of one text. So it's still a very hazy bit. But the oldest surviving Sanskrit texts date back to the Kushan period of 200 CE. So there's a lot of great debate still today circling all this literature. Now, the earliest known references to the Mahabharata and its core Bharata date to the Astantyayi of Panini, which is the 4th century BC. And this may mean that the core 24,000 verses known as the Bharata, as well as an early version of the extended epic, were composed by the 4th century. And a report by the Greek writer Dio Chrysostom about Homer's poetry being sung even in India seems to imply that the Iliad had been translated into Sanskrit. However, Indian scholars have in general taken this as evidence for the existence of Mahabharata at this date, whose episodes Dio or his sources identify with the story of the Iliad. So there are certain people who think that pieces of the Mahabharata are inspired or come directly from translations of the Iliad. But there are other scholars who believe that the Greeks who were in contact with people in India vis-a-vis the arrival of Alexander the Great and his armies from Macedonia and the Greek states, they believe that they took these stories with them and that the people in India constructed their own epic accordingly. But there are some scholars who believe that there was already an epic story in India, and that the Greeks simply came over and when they were exchanging goods, culture, and conflict with the people in India, they heard this story and they said, "Oh, that kind of sounds like what we've got," and immediately assumed that these guys were telling basically the same story. So, you know, probably we'll never know, but it's more likely that when the Greeks arrived, they heard a story that sounded pretty awesome and epic, which it is pretty awesome and epic, and they assumed that it was the same thing. Now, several stories within the Mahabharata take on separate identities of their own in classical Sanskrit literature, and various poets at various times. Various writers at various times take liberties with these stories and they take off and run with them. There's numerous examples of this. The epic itself can even be divided into 18 parvas or books. There's the Adi Parva, the book of the beginning, which is divided into like 1 to 19 little sub parvas. Like how the Mahabharata came to be narrated by Sauti to the assembly of rishis after having been recited previously. Then there's the Book of the Assembly Hall, the Sabha Parva, the Vana Parva, the Bharata Parva. There's just loads and loads of versions of this, and each one, or pieces of this, and each one is a different recitation, a different story, a piece of the story. There's different aspects of these great figures doing great things, culminating into the final 19th parva, known as the Harivamsa parva, with the book of the genealogy of Hari. This is an addendum to the 18 books and covers those parts of the life of Krishna which are not covered in the 18 parvas of the Mahabharata. So this entire collection of stories it's got loads of characters, from Arjuna to Krishna to Vishnu, Karna, loads and loads of big time figures in Hindu myth and Hindu religion that all interact together and all have a key piece that all hold a key piece of the puzzle in establishing not only this early India that Indian people were cultivating through this story, but also they also formed the framework for much of the philosophical, theological debates and discussions that are being had by these people. So it's a very influential piece of literature. Now, the core story of the work is that of a dynastic struggle for the throne of Hastinapura, the kingdom ruled by the Kuru clan. Now, the two collateral branches of the family that participate in the struggle are the Kaurava and the Pandava. Now, although the Kaurava is the senior branch of the family, the Duryodhana, the eldest Kaurava, is younger than another branch of the family, the Yudhisthira, the eldest Pandava. Now, both these branches claim to be the first in line to inherit the throne. This creates a struggle that culminates in the great battle of Kurukshetra, in which the Pandavas are ultimately victorious. Now, the battle produces conflicts of kinship and friendship, instances of family loyalty and duty taking precedence over what is right, as well as the converse of that. Now, Mahabharata itself ends with the death of Krishna, spoiler alert, and the subsequent end of his dynasty and the ascent of the Pandava brothers to heaven. It also marks the beginning of the Hindu age of Kali Yuga, the fourth and final age of humankind, in which great values and noble ideas have crumbled away and people are headed towards the complete dissolution of right action, morality, and virtue. So it ends in a rather sad way, and showing sort of the twilight years of humankind, putting basically present-day people in a permanent state of basically end times, headed towards an ultimate apocalypse. And these stories are quite fascinating. And we'll get directly into Karna and his role. But before we get in, so this is the background to this great story, the Mahabharata, and Karna is one of the legendary figures whose exploits are recorded in this epic. He is one of the big dogs that is fighting in this epic. He is a close friend of the Duryodhana, and he fights on his behalf against the Pandavas, his brothers, in this Kurukshetra war. He fights as Duryodhana's basically his general, his right hand man. He's the guy that Arjuna, the great hero, his armies are going to have to contend with throughout this epic. And ultimately, because of this, because Karna is basically standing on the wrong side of the conflict, as we will see, it doesn't really work out for him. Now, before we get into Karna and how he factors into the Mahabharata, we're going to take a commercial break. Totally Driven Entertainment, it would behoove me to mention that we do have a new sponsor, and we're very proud to have this new sponsor here at Totally Driven. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisBraileyPresents.com for some great content that'll make you laugh. Unlike today's story about Karna, which might actually make you cry and maybe laugh a little bit, but we'll get into that when we come back from the commercial break.
I am black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraileyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromhomes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin on the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Bareback Facts. Before the break, we went through a bit of a long historical discussion of the epic Mahabharata, and now we're going to get to the meat and potatoes of the story. We're going to talk about Karna, talk about the fact that he is part of a dynastic struggle for control of the kingdom. Originally known as Vasusena is the main protagonist in this epic. The epic describes him as the king of Anga, which is present-day Bhagalpur and Munger. Karna was the best archer in the epic story. He was the greatest of all warriors, whose martial exploits are recorded in the epic, and one of the warriors who defeated and compelled the legendary hero Arjuna to flee from the battle. An admiration expressed by Lord Krishna and Bhishma within the body of this work. As per the Mahabharata, Karna was the only warrior in that era who conquered the entire world. He single-handedly, successfully conducted Digvijaya Yatra, a campaign in which he conquered all kings in every direction of the world, and was instrumental in establishing Duryodhana as the emperor of the world and to conduct the Vaishnava sacrifice. Karna was equal to two Maratha warriors. Now, what are Maratha warriors? A Maharathi is a warrior capable of fighting more than 12 Rathi-class warriors simultaneously, circumspect in his mastery of all forms of weapons, combat skills. These are a list of these individuals who are Maharathi. This is the highest level of warrior that one can reach. As related in Hindu epics, a Maharathi is a warrior having mastered all forms of weapons and combat skills. They are masters of every form of strategy and military tactic that exists. Simultaneously, they are masters of every weapon that exists. Among them are basically Lord Rama, Indrajit, Bhishma, Guru Drona, Karna, Arjuna, Lord Krishna, and basically everybody that's a master is pretty much a god. So basically, that gives you an idea of how powerful Karna is. And keep in mind that he is human. at the outset of this story. He is, in fact, a human being at the outset of this story, and yet he is a master of all forms of weapons. He's a master of all. He's a jack of all trades and master of them all. Instead of just being a master of none, he's literally a master of everything that he puts his hands to. He is the first son of Surya and Kunti, and born to Kunti before her marriage with Pandu. Karna was the closest friend of Duryodhana and fought on his behalf against the Pandavas, his brothers, to a war. Now, Karna fought against misfortune throughout his life, and he kept his word under every circumstance. Over every circumstance, he kept his word. And this is one of the things that really ends up screwing him in the end. Now, it is believed that Karna founded the city of Karnal in present Haryana, but Karna is often quoted for his sacrifice, courage, charity, valor, and selflessness. He sounds like a great guy, right? Let's get into a little bit deeper into what Karna does and who he is and some of the things that he's got going on for him. So Karna possesses three celestial weapons. These celestial weapons are gifts from the gods themselves that Karna is going to use to wreck shop. That's right, baby. He is going to use these epic weapons to be the ultimate ass kicker. There's really not a whole lot anybody can do about it. And eventually the gods start to realize that maybe Karna wasn't the guy we should be giving this stuff to. So the first weapon on the list is known as the Visabi Shakti, and he got it from the celestial king of the gods, Indra, when he granted him his Kavaka and Kundal. Now, on the 14th day of the Kurukshetra War, when the battle continued after sunset, he used it to kill the Pandava demon supporter and Bhima's son, Ghatotkacha. Now, what is this weapon? To be honest with you, we're not exactly certain exactly what this weapon is, but we do know that it is very powerful. It could be anything from a bow to a whatever. We just know it's an epic weapon that he has. Now, the next we have on the list is the Nagastra, the Snake King. Ashwasena wanted to kill Arjuna as he destroyed his dynasty, so he entered to Karna's Nagastra, and on the 17th day of the Kurukshetra War, when Karna was the commander of the Kaurava army, he faced Arjuna, and he shot his Astra at him after a fierce battle. One individual named Shalaya, who was the charioteer of Karna, asked him to shoot Arjuna with the Astra at his chest, so he would die, but the Kaurava commander thought that he was telling him falsehood, so he shot it on his head, and due to his foolishness, Krishna saved Arjuna by this. Now, this is thought to be his bow, a magical bow. Last is the Bhargavastra, which when Karna is cursed by Parshurama, he cried to him for forgiveness, so he granted him his own made Astra. And this is the Bhargavastra, and it's a celestial bow of Shiva called the Vijaya, which was far better than Gandiva, and he used it on the 17th day of the Kurukshetra War, killing an Akshuhanis of the Pandava army. So he's got a load of weapons. This guy is armed to the teeth with magical weapons that basically nobody can contain. And for those of you unfamiliar with the Hindu epics, these battles that take place sometimes take place in the heavens, and they tend to end up with lots of people ended up dead, which is always good for the audience. We want to see a lot of people end up dead in the stories, right? I mean, what is a hero movie or story without a bunch of dead people? The name he came to be renowned for in the epic was Karna, which means the cutter and peeler of his own skin. Yeah, this guy's a little bit of the savage, as the young people would call him. Now, as a young woman, Kunti, the princess of the Kunti kingdom, had been granted a boon by sage Durvasa to be able to invoke any deity to give her a child, so she could call any god to come down and get her pregnant. I mean, these ancient people just have it so good. They can call down the gods to get them pregnant. I mean, you know, we got to use all these apps and stuff to get dates. They're straight up calling gods down. I mean, where do you sign up for that app? I mean, I'm down. I'll call down Artemis or somebody. Hook me up, ladies. Come on. Where are we at? What's with these goddesses? Somebody needs to invent that app. Now, eager to test the power, while still unmarried, she called upon the solar deity Surya and was handed a son, Karna, wearing armor, Kavasha, and a pair of earrings, Kundala. Now, afraid of being unwed mother and having an illegitimate son, Kunta placed the baby in a basket and sent him afloat on a river. The child was found by Adhiratha, a charioteer king of Hastinapur, and Adhiratha and his wife Radha raised the boy as their own and named him Vasusenya. He also became known as the Radheya, the son of Radha. Now, Karna became interested in the art of warfare and approached Dhrakacharya, an established teacher who taught the Kuru princes. But he refused to take Karna as his student since Karna was not a Kshatriya. And for those of you not familiar, Kshatriya is a class of warrior. There is a caste system that is put into place by these epics, by the Rig Vedas, and by the early texts. Kshatriyas were the warrior class, and to be a warrior, you had to be born into that class. But according to some versions of the tale, appreciating Karna's boldness, Drona tells Adhiratha to call his son Karna. Now, after being refused by Drona, Karna wanted to learn advanced skills of archery, and hence he decided to learn from Parashurama, Drona's own guru. So he says, "You won't teach me what I want to know, so I'm going to go above your head." As Parashurama only taught Brahmins, Karna appeared before him as such. This is another class of people. These are nobles and landowners. Now, Parashurama accepted him and trained him to such a point that he declared Karna to be equal to himself in the art of warfare and archery. Now, Karna appeared before him in the guise of a Brahmin. On a day towards the end of his training, Karna happened to offer Parashurama to his lap so his guru could rest his head and take a nap. Whilst he was asleep, a bee stung Karna's thigh. Now, despite the pain, Karna did not move so as not to disturb his guru. Now, in some versions, Lord Indra became afraid of the fighting prowess of Karna, and he himself took on the form of a bee and stung Karna in order to benefit his son Arjuna, who's going to have to face him later. But when Parashurama woke up and saw the blood oozing from Karna's wound, he once deduced that Karna was not a Brahmin. Enraged, he accused Karna of stealing knowledge, and he laid a curse upon Karna that he would forget all the knowledge required to wield the Brahmanda Astra. Now, upon Karna's pleading, Parashurama relented and modified his curse, saying that Karna would only lose the knowledge when he needed it most, whilst fighting a warrior of equal skill to himself. Now, this curse would come back to haunt him in his final fight against the warrior Arjuna, who ends up becoming his equal. Rewarding Karna's diligence, he was given the personal celestial weapon, the Bhargavastra, which no one else possessed. Repenting over a curse made in anger, and in order to nullify said curse, Parashurama also gave Karna his personal bow, Vijaya, to be ever victorious in battle and blessed. Now, these weapons are pretty epic. He can do a lot of crazy stuff with these weapons. Now, the Bhargavastra is at its root the Astra. It's a supernatural weapon presided over by a specific deity, and it later comes to denote any weapon which was used in releasing it from one's hand, an arrow, a sword, a spear, what have you. To give you an idea of how powerful these weapons are, I'm going to pull up the Bhargavastra. This is given to Karna. The Bhargavastra is said to have caused great damage to the Pandava's army. It destroyed some foot soldiers of the Pandava army, and it possessed all the skills of archery. Only the greatest archer could wield it. So then we look at the Vijaya, Shiva, or otherwise known as the bow of Shiva the Destroyer. The Vijaya was the personal bow of Lord Indra, and it was given to Karna, it's so heavy that a normal person cannot lift it. Karna, or an equally more powerful warrior, the only person that can lift it is Lord Parashurama, and Karna, or an equally more powerful warrior. Nobody can even pick it up. The only time Karna ever fought using the Vajraya was during the Kshetra War, when he got killed by Arjuna, who was using Gandiva's bow. But it can lay waste to an entire kingdom. So this guy's basically walking around with the equivalent of an ancient nuclear weapon. To give you an idea of how powerful this guy is, he can literally lay waste to an entire city with these weapons. Karna is cursed also again. He's cursed by a Brahmin for killing his cow while practicing his skills with a bow and arrow. Imagine that. The Brahmin gets angry and curses him that he would die helpless in the same way that his innocent cow had died. And again, this is going to come back and bite him in the afton as well. He later meets Duryodhana, and they exchange in a friendly tournament. His student Arjuna, third of the Pandava brothers, was a gifted archer. Karna arrives at the tournament uninvited, surpasses Arjuna, and challenges him to a duel. Now, Kripacharya refused Karna's duel, asking first for his clan and kingdom, for according to the rules of dueling, only a prince could challenge Arjuna to a duel. So he shows up, he whips him in this game, and then he says, "Hey, you're pretty tough. I want to fight, but only a prince can challenge a prince." And so Kripacharya says, no, you can't just challenge the prince. It doesn't matter how talented you are; you have to be at his level to challenge him. Now, due to his low standing, Karna was not allowed to fight Arjuna. He's further insulted by Bhima, who compared him to a stray dog for his mix and lineage. This incident marks the beginning of a feud between Karna and the Pandavas. So if he wasn't already not happy with these guys, that pretty much set that was the piss in his Cheerios that made him really not like the Pandavas. Now, Duryodhana, the eldest of the 100 sons of the king of this kingdom at the time, Dhritarashtra, was envious of the martial prowess of his cousins, the Pandavas. The Pandavas are pretty strong guys. He's not as strong as them, despite being older than them. Now, he sees Karna as a chance to get on even terms with him, and he immediately offers Karna the throne of the kingdom of Anga, making him a king, and now eligible to fight a duel with Arjuna. So he says, "Hey, I'm going to carve out a little bit of my kingdom, give it to you, and here you go. Now you're a king. Now you can go kill my brother, if you want to." Now, neither of them knows that Karna is, in fact, Kunti's eldest son, born to the sun god Surya, so obviously more than able to challenge Arjuna to a duel to begin with, but nobody knows that. When Karna asked him what he could do to repay him, Duryodhana told him that all he wanted was his friendship, which we all know at this point is definitely not true. Now, Karna later married a woman belonging to the Suta caste as per the wishes of his father, Adaratha. Now, Karna later has a fight with another individual named Yarasadha. Karna helps Duryodhana marry the princess of Kalinga, who Duryodhana had a ceremony in a chariot, and Karna fights with the rest of the suitors. Many legendary rulers like Shishupala, Yarasandha, Vishamaka, all these guys, all these big name heroes from these different stories that are being told, all show up to kill Karna, and they're all killed by him. The ashamed Jarasandha, the king of Magadha, later challenges Karna to a one-on-one fight, and they fight continuously with different weapons until Karna defeats him by trying to tear him apart during a wrestling fight. So they basically figure out these weapons are just not going to work out. Let's just fight hand-to-hand now. And they do, and Karna pretty much rips this guy to pieces almost. So Yarasandha says, "Yeah, I'm going to surrender now. I'll be it torn to pieces. Let's get this over with." So in exchange, Karna spares his life. Yarasandha gifts him the city of Malini to Karna as a token of his appreciation, probably because he didn't want to be torn to pieces. And the victory made Karna famous. Later, following his accession to the throne of Malini, Karna takes an oath that anyone who approached him with a request when he worshipped the sun would not leave empty-handed. Now, upon prodding by his uncle Shakuni, Duryodhana goes forward with a plot to kill the Pandavas through treachery, apparently succeeding. Throughout the planning and execution, Karna tries to convince his friend to call it off, desiring to defeat the Pandavas with honor on the battlefield. Well, Karna, being a hardcore badass warrior, says, don't just betray these guys and poison them or try to kill them in an underhanded way. Let me kick their ass. I'm awesome. Look at me, dude. I'm destroying entire cities with my bow. Let me kill these guys. Now, Karna was a suitor for the Princess Draupadi. And unlike most of her contenders, he was easily able to wield and string the bow. But she refused to allow him to take part in the games for her heart, rejecting him for his caste. Now, having escaped Varnavat after burning Nishada's women and children, the Pandavas were also present in this region, the Swayamvara, disguised as Brahmins. Now, following the failure of the other princes, Arjuna steps into the ring and successfully hits the target in these games, winning Draupadi's hand and further increasing Karna's disdain for him. Now, the assembled kings argued that a Brahmin was ineligible, and they took their weapons and attacked the disguised Arjuna. Arjuna fights with Karna and is soon overpowered by him. Arjuna then lies that he is a Brahmin, so he is spared by Karna, because Karna is not supposed to kill a nobleman. Now, after Shakuni wins a game of dice by trickery, Draupadi, now queen to all five Pandavas, is dragged to the court by Dushasana and Duryodhana, and his brothers attempted to strip her. Karna exposed Draupadi, saying that a woman with more than one husband is nothing but a cheat, and Arjuna subsequently swears to kill Karna for exposing that truth. It's nothing but an uncheat. So, later, after the Pandavas are in exile, Karna takes up the task of establishing his buddy Duryodhana as the emperor of the world. But all Duryodhana wanted from Karna was his friendship, not to be emperor of the world. Well, yeah, whatever. So we're pretty much going to see that that's not the case. So Karna embarks upon a worldwide military campaign, otherwise called the Digvijaya Yatra. He conquers every king in every direction and subjugates their kingdom, making them swear allegiance to Duryodhana as the king of Hastinapur. And those who fail to do so are completely obliterated. In this military adventure, Karna waged wars all over the world and made submissions of entire kingdoms in the world. Among these include the Panchals, the king of the Himalayas, the Angas, the Kalingas, the Magadhas, the Chedi, the Yavana, etc. Basically, everybody that they could come up with, and people, you know, there's no name after name after name after name after name. Every king that you could possibly ever imagine, this guy supposedly conquered them. Now, having thus conquered and brought under his subjection the entire world, Karna comes back to Hastinapura with immense wealth and power the world had never witnessed before. King Dhritarashtra praised Karna, comparing him favorably to those like Bhishma and Drona, who had never returned such tribute. Bringing tribute and allegiance from all the world's kings, Karna helped Duryodhana to perform the Vashanavya Yagna to please Vishnu and crown Duryodhana as the emperor of the world, as Yudhishthira did with the Rajasuya Yagna. No person in the entire universe except the god Vishnu and Idrijit, the son of Ravana, had ever performed this sacrifice before. Thus, Duryodhana became the most powerful and the most wealthiest man in the world. Now, Duryodhana even made plans and preparations to conquer Indra, the lord of the heavens, and the father Arjuna with the help of Karna in order to become the sovereign ruler of both heaven and earth. So, at this point, after conquering all the known world, Duryodhana is not satisfied. He talks to Karna, and Karna says, "You want me to go to heaven and kick the gods' asses out of there and take it over for you? Done deal, buddy. I'm in. I've been conquering the whole world for you. I'm richer than I've ever been. Life is great. Nobody can hold my stuff. Let's do this. So they start planning to conquer heaven itself. Now, it's at this point that things are going to take a little bit of a turn here. The gods are not going to let this happen. They're not feeling it. They're also not very happy that Karn has conquered all the known world. But Nava elder brother Yudhisthira had always considered Karna as the foremost warrior in the world and worries about this fact in the prelude to their war. Now, the god Indra realized that Karna would be invincible in battle and unable to be killed so long as he had his kavak and kundalan. So these earrings that he wore and his outer layer of skin are actually an impenetrable gold armor. The earrings preserve his vitality, and this armor makes it basically impossible. This armored skin he has makes it impossible for him to be injured. He approaches Karna as a poor Brahmin during Karna's sun worship, and Surya warned Karna of Indra's intentions, but Karna thanked Surya and explained that he was bound by his word and could not send anyone away from his door empty-handed. When Indra approaches Karna in the form of a Brahmin beggar, a fallen lord, and asks his kavak and kundal as alms, Karna reveals that he knew the Brahmin's identity, but assured that he would never turn anyone away. Indra becomes ashamed and takes his own normal form. Cutting the armor and earrings off his body, Karna hands them to the god, and as he does so, the heavens open up, and all the gods and celestial beings in realms appear in the sky and shower flowers on Karna, which is pretty nice of him, but he just had to rip his own skin off and give it, his outer layer of skin off, and give it to this guy. They praised that it was the greatest charity the world had ever witnessed. In order to escape from such severe shame, Lord Indra asked Karna to accept a gift in return. Karna rejects the offer, telling that he didn't give charity expecting anything in return. All gods, devas, sages, and celestial beings requested Karna to accept any gift in return in order to save them from the insult that was caused by Indra upon them. Obeying the celestial beings and as per the request of Lord Indra, and Karna, as his father had instructed him, asked for the Vasavi Shakti, and Indra granted it to him with the stipulation that Karna could only use the weapon one time. In some versions of the story, Indra gave Karna the name Karna for this great act, which, you know, the one who peels his own skin off. Brings a whole new meaning to, I'll give you the shirt off my back. I'll literally give you my back. Here you go. Take my back. Now, following failed peace negotiations with Duryodhana, Lord Krishna is driven back to the Pandavas by Karna. He doesn't have his invincibility turned on anymore. Karna's still kicking people's asses. He whips Krishna, who's later going to be a god. Krishna then reveals to Karna that he is the eldest son of Kunti and therefore technically the eldest Pandava, implores him to change sides, and assures him that the crown would go to him. Draupadi, who rejected him earlier, will become his wife, and even Duryodhana will happily see his friend get the crown. Shaken from the discovery, Karna refuses these offers over his loyalty to Duryodhana. Now, Krishna is saddened, but appreciates Karna's sense of loyalty and accepts the decision, promising that Karna that his lineage would remain a secret. In addition, Karna was elated to learn that his true father was none other than Surya, the god. Krishna goes to Kunti and asks her to emotionally blackmail Karna by revealing the truth about his birth, demonstrating that he's a bit of an asshole. According to Krishna, when Karna knows about his real identity, it will emotionally weaken him, and Kunti can manipulate Karna. Krishna told Kunti that it is up to her to make a decision to choose between Karna and her five other sons. As the war approached, Kunti met Karna, and in desperation to keep her children alive, asked Karna to join the Pandavas. She reveals the truth about his birth, and Karna is, in fact, emotionally weakened. His hatred against the Pandavas becomes weakened, but he rejects the offer again, knowing that Karna will fight against Arjuna with a motive to kill. Kunti extracts a couple of promises for Karna that he will not kill any of the Pandavas except Arjuna, and against Arjuna, he will not use a same celestial weapon twice. So he's got three weapons. He can only use each one time now. A particular request by Kunti, as suggested by Lord Krishna, led to the death of Karna in the war, as he did not use the Nagastra and the Rudrastra twice against Lord Arjuna. Now, Lord Krishna knew that Lord Parashurama had gifted entire celestial weapons to Karna and Arjuna that don't have any counter to many and don't have any to counter many of these weapons. Now, Karna requested his mother to keep their relationship a secret till the end of the war, as the Pandavas will not fight against their own brother, and he really wants to fight these guys because he doesn't like them. We're skipping ahead here. Ahead a little bit here. Because there's a great number of details that we've gone through here. Now, finally, here we go. We get to this. This all culminates into a battle that lasts basically a 17-day battle, where all the Pandavas and these gods get together, and they decide it's time to have it out. There's only one guy that can stand and be king. Only one group can win this all. It's on the 17th day of the war that Karna defeats Yudhishthira. Sorry, guys, it's a bit of a tongue twister of a name. That's the king of the Pandavas at the time. He also defeats Bhima in duels as well. And up to this point, he's pretty much defeated a bunch of people. Up to this point, he's also kept his word. Prior to the 17th day, on the 16th day, as promised, Karna aimed only at killing Arjuna. He fought with all the Pandava brothers, but Arjuna, and defeated them all in direct combat, sparing each one of their lives after insulting them with harsh words. So he kicks all their asses, and then he calls them morons for getting into it with him to begin with. After one of his buddies dies, he orders his charioteer to move towards Arjuna and decides to finish him off once and for all. So violent and offensive were Karna's attacks that Arjuna's defenses soon crumble before it. Karna then moves in for the kill. He arms his Nagastra, the same celestial weapon that was used by Indrajit against Rama in the Ramayana. And intervening, his charioteer tells him to aim it at Arjuna's chest. Frustrated at his constant insults, Karna believes that the advice must be bad and instead aims at Arjuna's head. Krishna saves Arjuna from certain death by lowering their chariot wheel into the earth. The arrow then strikes Arjuna's helmet instead of his head, and Karna and Arjuna then wage a rough war against each other. Remember that at this point he wasted his shot. He only has one shot to kill him. So he can only use his celestial weapons one time each against Arjuna. So they then wage a rough war against one another. As promised, Karna used a celestial weapon only once against Arjuna. Regaining the upper hand, Karna has a chance to kill Arjuna, but spares the latter as the sun was about to set. And in some versions of the tale, Lord Krishna realized that only miracles can save his ward Arjuna from death and cause the sun to set prematurely. Lord Krishna then makes plans to kill Karna by cheating and reveals this plan to Arjuna. He tells Arjuna that there will come a time where Karna will be defenseless and unarmed, and that is the time for Arjuna to strike. So, it's on the 17th day, after the king and one of his buddy Bhima are soundly defeated by Karna in duels, when the Kaurava troops are hard-pressed by their opponents, Karna uses the Bhargavastra against the Pandava army, and as a result, heavy casualties are inflicted. This weapon is said to be able to unleash so many arrows, basically, that it just there's nothing there. It's like a hailstorm. There's no escape. There's no dodging this weapon. Now, Arjuna is able to counter it, however. Remember that he does have celestial weapons, but he is unable to counter it. And so Krishna causes him to desist and retreat temporarily so he doesn't get caught in the crossfire of this weapon. They then visit Yudhishthira, who was outside the battlefield, having been badly wounded by Karna's weapons, and he insults Arjuna for leaving, saying, what the hell you think you're doing? You're supposed to be my guy. Get out there and get it done. Now, after the Bhargavastra was withdrawn, the battle resumes. Insulted by the king, Arjuna returns to the battlefield, and Karna and Arjuna face each other again. To witness this great battle between the greatest of all heroes, the heavens themselves open up. All beings from all the higher realms appear in the sky. They're ready to watch this. This is their WrestleMania. Okay, they appeared, all the devas, celestial rishas, asparas, Gandharva, and all the beings in the higher realms, and they offered flowers to these great warriors. The asuras and beings from the lower realms also appeared. So all the angels and the gods and every higher celestial being imaginable shows up, and then all the demons and monsters show up, and they want to watch. Everything that's good in the universe, everything that's bad in the universe, it's all stopping. It's all going to stop. They're going to stop and stare while these two guys kill each other. Now, both Pandava and Kaurava forces also stop their fight, and they assemble on their respective sides to watch the battle. So even all the soldiers who were fighting before have now stopped. They are going to watch Karna and Arjuna kill each other. As the battle starts, the warriors on the battlefield and the devas in heaven watch the battle in speechless amazement and terrified admiration of the strength and skill of these, the greatest warriors the world has ever known. Karna cuts the string of Arjuna's bow many times. As the battle intensifies, Arjuna pushed back Karna's chariot 10 steps backward every time by the energy of the arrows he's firing at it. But Karna is only able to push Arjuna's chariot 2 steps backwards. Seeing this, Lord Krishna praised Karna and admired his skill. When questioned by Arjuna, Krishna said that it is impossible for any human ever to push his chariot backwards because the chariot of Arjuna contains both Hanuman and Krishna, thus holding the entire weight of the universe. So basically, Karna moved something that is the equivalent of the weight of the entire universe with his arrows. Even to shake the chariot is an impossible task, but Karna is pushing it 2 feet every time by the energy of the arrows that he is firing. Krishna said no human had ever had, nor ever will attain this feat, as it is impossible to shake the chariot containing Mahavishnu. The epic states that initially the battle was even between them, but then Karna's chariot wheel is trapped in the mud. As a result of the curse he received earlier from a Brahmin, he still defended himself, but at the crucial moment forgot the incantations to invoke the Brahmanda Astra as a result of his guru Pashurama's curse. Now remember, his guru had told him that he would forget the knowledge he needed at the very moment he needed it. And remember that the Brahmin had said that he would die defenseless, like his cow did. Karna got down from his chariot to free the wheel and asked Arjuna to wait, reminding him of the etiquette of war. Hey man, listen. You got to let me get out of this. Now, Arjuna has some thoughts about this. Arjuna is a little unhappy about this. Krishna says, Arjuna, what the hell are you talking about? Waiting? We ain't waiting. We haven't been able to kill this guy yet. Get in there and kill him. He tells him, forget the rules of engagement. This is war. Go murder him. Now, enraged, Arjuna attacks Karna while he's trying to lift his sunken chariot wheel, and Karna decides to defend himself and invokes the Rudrasta, hitting Arjuna on his chest. Now, Arjuna is hurt as a consequence of this and loses his grip on his weapon, Gandharva, which falls down from his hand for the first time. Following the rules of engagement of war, Karna did not try to kill Arjuna because he's unconscious, but instead tries to utilize the time in extracting the wheels of his chariot. And during this time, Arjuna recovers and using the Anjalika weapon, decapitates Karna, who is still trying to lift the sunken chariot wheel. Though it's highly forbidden, according to the rules of engagement of the war, to attack a weaponless warrior or to attack any weapon from the back, any enemy from behind, Arjuna attacks Karna from the back and kills him, as suggested by Krishna, and it is later revealed that Karna could be killed only when all 3 curses acted together upon him, and this made Krishna employ deceit to kill Karna. It's said that Duryodhana never shed a single teardrop for any of his real brothers who were killed in the battle, but when his beloved friend Karna was slain, he was inconsolable. So turns out in the end, despite the fact that Duryodhana was kind of crappy to Karna throughout his life, he was still
he actually had some genuine feelings for the guy. So what can we take away from Karna? There's a lot of themes in this story. A lot of themes come together in this story. You know, his life is one of tragedy and sacrifice. But he starts out lowborn, rises to great heights. He finds out that he's related to the people that he's come to despise. And instead of letting bygones be bygones, Karna is not willing to do this. He's going to kill these guys. He's going to kill them because he wants to. Because his personal vendetta against them is that they insulted him years back, and he wants to kill them for it. He also takes up Duryodhana as his friend, despite the fact that Duryodhana really doesn't have his best interests at heart. He has his own best interests at heart. Now, his life went through various pitches of tragedy and sacrifice. Alternately, he displayed a sense of sacrifice continuously, but no good ever came of it because he was destroyed by the one thing that mattered to him most. He wanted to be somebody that he was not, at least in the society in which he lived in. So despite the fact that Karna was, in fact, noble, in reality, as far as society was concerned, he wasn't, and he was determined to prove them wrong. He's so determined by this fact that he lets that blind him. Because of his obsession, he continuously blunders. He's an intelligent guy and has enough sense to see that Duryodhana subjugating the world is probably going to lead to a very bad battle. He knows that waging war against your family is not a good thing. You're not supposed to do that, but he does it anyway. And he goads on Duryodhana many, many times, and Duryodhana eventually even dies. And he could have been saved if Karna had used his intelligence rather than his sense of loyalty and gratitude. He failed to use this and continuously blundered as a consequence of this. It's also ultimately cost him his life. When Krishna comes to sue for peace, he speaks to Karna and says, "Why are you doing this to yourself? This is not what you are. Let me tell you what your parentage is." Remember, Krishna reveals to him who he is. Karna breaks down because he'd always wanted to know where he came from and always wanted to know who he was, but suddenly realized that he'd been actively trying to nurture hatred towards the five Pandavas, even though it was not naturally so. Because of his gratitude to Duryodhana, somewhere he believed he must hate these people. Though there's no hatred in his heart, he works it up all the time and comes out meaner than anyone. So there's no real reason for him to hate his family. Yes, they were rude to him like one time or two times, because they didn't know who he was. But once it's revealed to him that he's related to them and they also know it, they try to convince him to come on home, man. We didn't even know you were related to us, but you are. Come home. You belong with us. You belong on our side. You're our brother. Come home. And he still says, "No, I'm loyal to Duryodhana. I've sworn my loyalty to him." It didn't matter. His loyalty to this lord that he had sworn was more important to him. And his loyalty is what screws him over. So is Karna a good guy or a bad guy? He's neither. He's a guy who's caught in the middle. He's everything you want your epic hero to be. He's a hero, but not in the sense that he is, you know, trying to preserve, you know, something. He's a hero in the sense that he is sacrificing himself out of loyalty for Duryodhana, even if it is under the guise of Duryodhana's machinations for world domination, even if it is a little bit of a delusion, and if it is motivated by his dislike for the Pandavas, Karna is still a hero, and he does achieve great fame because of the heroic deeds that he performs. He possesses, and yes, his possession of these epic weapons allows him to do so, But Karna demonstrates some of the qualities that we value in a hero, something that makes him an actual hero. The number one thing that makes for a hero, in my opinion, I said this on Wednesday, but the number one thing is that is sacrifice. There has to be something on the line for this person. Karna puts himself on the line in every single battle that he's in. And in his final battle, he knows that he's no longer invincible, and he still goes anyway and takes on the most powerful warriors in the world. He even fights against gods without his invulnerability. So for me, this makes Karna a real hero because he's going to stick to his loyalties. He's going to stick to his guns, and he's going to do what he needs to do, even if he doesn't have the necessary tools to try and get it done. He's also a tragic hero because in the end, his loyalties do cost him his life, but it's also not that just that. It's the betrayal of those around him. But if there's one thing that you also have to take into consideration with Karna is that Karna has to die in the most convoluted of circumstances. Three curses have to come into effect. They all have to come into effect at the exact same time. And even in spite of all that, Karna almost defies the odds and comes out on top, but it wasn't to be. The deceitfulness of his enemy, their willingness to stoop to any depths to win at any cost, and his inability to see that is what cost Karna in the end. Guys, I hope you've enjoyed learning the legend of Karna. I want to suggest that you guys to Mahabharata. You can take a look at various translations of it. Kesari Mohan's The Mahabharata book translation is a good start for you. You can also take a look at www.karna.org, which is an entire website that is dedicated to sort of translation and story of Karna. You can look at The Curse and Blessing of Parashurama, the Mahabharata. Which is at www.sacredtext.com. It's a solid article that is directly from the translation from that text, the Mahabharata. You can get translations of the Mahabharata. There are multiples that you can take a look at. I'd also suggest you take a look at Michael Witzel's early Sanskritization, Origin and Development of the Kuru State as well. So that's all I've got for you guys today. I hope you enjoyed learning about Karna. He's a tragic hero, but he's a guy that is definitely one you don't hear enough about. And despite the fact that he goes out in a bit of a sad way, couldn't have it any other way. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. But that's all I've got for you guys today. Hope you enjoyed the show. See you all on Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time for Straight Football Talk. Enjoy your weekend, guys, and do stay warm out there. The weather has been getting nasty. This winter is crazy.